It's time to talk about Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. And now, here's Ira.
How about this for a record? A 43-year history, 22 albums, 17 Grammy nominations, and 2 Grammy Awards. Well, one of the members of the group that has this record is my guest. He's Russell Ferrante, and of course, it's the Yellow Jackets. The group will be performing in Myron's at the Smith Center this Saturday, April 20th at 6 and 8:30, so 2 shows. For ticket information, go to thesmithcenter.com, and for everything about the Yellow Jackets, go to yellowjackets.com. And Russell, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ira. Good to be here.
Pleasure. How did you get started with music to begin with? I know there's a long history with the group, but just you personally, how did you get involved with music and in specifically the piano?
Right. Well, my father was active in church music. He was the choir director growing up. And my mom had also been a musician. She played violin and some piano. But my dad's work with the church was really the impetus. He thought one day maybe I could be the choir accompanist, and gave me piano lessons, and also my sister, who actually is a music minister in the Bay Area. So she kind of fulfilled the family aspirations. I went a slightly different direction.
So it took the pressure off of you a little bit, right?
Yeah, actually, I think that's true.
Yeah. So you started getting taught piano, but then you decided to make that choice of going and playing professionally. So before the start of the group, and we can talk about how all that started with, I believe Robin Ford was the instigator mm-hmm. for the initial part of the group. But even before then, what path did you take to decide to go down that road of professional musicianship?
Yeah. Well, I actually, as a youth, I mean, I was taking lessons from about the age of 9. And then I think I stopped taking lessons around maybe late teens, but then a friend in high school introduced me to jazz. He was a drummer, and we got together at his house and started playing, and I was just completely smitten with music and jazz. And I wasn't ready to fully commit at that time because I was really into sports. I played basketball. I had some basketball scholarships to some colleges. And I played 1 year at San Jose State University. And then I realized these guys are really big. I'm not quite as big. And the jazz band met at the same time as basketball practice. And so second year, I made the decision, let me just pursue music. And so that was in San Jose. I played with a lot of different musicians in the San Francisco Bay Area, and lived in San Francisco for 2 years before moving down to Los Angeles. And that was 1977, I believe. And you mentioned Robin Ford, and mm-hmm. I knew Robin from the Bay Area, and I actually started playing with him when I was 21 years old. He was working with the blues singer Jimmy Witherspoon, and that was my really first professional touring music job, and that was with Robin's band backing. He was known as Spoon.
So yeah. Then you get together with Robin and the guys, and you start playing, and it becomes, of course, the group that has been around for quite a while at this point.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, yeah, looking back, it's difficult to grasp all of that. I mean, from our perspective, we're making music, we're trying to learn more, write, meet the obligations that come with having a band, and here we are 4 decades plus on. So it's, you know, I have to say, it's really, I am more aware of how fortunate I am to be able to do this. It's a serious gratitude check, you know, that you can make your living doing something you love to do. And it's still really challenging and great fun. I can't imagine not doing it.
You seem very relaxed too. So that obviously you've come to that appreciation point in your life where, as you say, all these decades later, yeah, still getting to do what you love to do.
Right.
You know, I was hesitant about how to describe the band initially because I've heard it described a couple of different ways. And you at least opened the door by saying how you fell in love with jazz. And I've heard Yellow Jackets connected with fusion jazz or jazz fusion and other types of descriptions. What would, from your point of view, how would you describe the band?
Yeah, well, I think if you consider fusion, you know, a melding of different influences, it's certainly that, which are really all music, you know, borrows from different things. I mean, jazz takes inspiration from the blues and, you know, European music, classical music. So, but I would say at the heart of what we do is the ensemble aspect and really trying to improvise, like group improvisation. Every set, we pick a different group of songs to play. We don't have like a set repertoire every night. You know, we'll kind of decide before we play what songs we'll play. Sometimes they're songs we maybe haven't played in a while, but just to challenge ourselves. And we really strive to be in the moment and make that performance something, you know, special and authentic, you know, happening in this moment at this time. So that means a lot of listening. It's very conversational music. You know, we're listening to one another, and we're also feeling the audience and, you know, what kind of feedback are we getting from the people that are listening? You know, what are they responding to? Yeah, it's this very organic experience. And yeah, that's how I would describe it. And it's our original music. We write all our own songs, but there's a certain kind of structures and sound to the band. And I think it's just the combination of these four particular musicians.
And I want to mention two of the others. Bob Mincer, who's on woodwinds.
Mm-hmm.
Will Kennedy on drums. Dane Alderson on bass.
That's correct.
And yes. I always like to recognize all the members of the band, even if I'm not talking with them. So that, the one thing you mentioned, something I want to go back to for a second, the original music. And it's true because I looked at your albums going all the way back. And with the exception of that Christmas album or the holiday album,
mm-hmm,
pretty much it's not your standard jazz music that borrows from the Great American Songbook or from other popular songs. It's a much more of an original presentation.
Yes, that's true. And, you know, I love standards in the Great American Songbook. And that's, you know, maybe for jazz musicians, that is like learning Bach and Chopin for a classical musician. That's really the jumping off point. Those chord structures and melodies and the forms of those songs are what informs really everything that came after it. So we're familiar with that music, and you know, we'll all play other little gigs around town or different things where we're playing, you know, as a sideman, I might play that music. But with Yellow Jackets, part of really the joy is writing and composing our own music and recording it. And so that's what we present.
I want to mention your new album, current album, is Parallel Motion.
Correct.
And that's available. If you go to the website, again, is yellowjackets.com, and you can get all the information from the website, as well as all a bunch of stuff on the band itself and the history and everything else. So it's a fascinating story there. When you look at the evolution of the group, because you started out originally with Jimmy Haslip and Ricky Lawson, and you mentioned Robin Ford, et cetera. So over time, the group evolved, new members came into the band. You're the sort of what I call the torchbearer or the culture setter for the band. Was it easy, hard, challenging, whatever the word would be to, I'm going to use this word in a positive way, indoctrinate the new members of the band into what you wanted?
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting. Well, first I'll say that the band, it's leaderless. There is no leader in Yellow Jackets. So each of the four musicians has equal say in what happens. So as you would imagine, changing one musician is going to impact the whole thing. It's going to change the sound. And we've tried to be really, careful in the people that we've associated with and you know, chosen to be in the band. I mean, they're people that are like-minded, you know, have similar musical experience and taste. But we don't really tell, like, a new person that joins the band. The latest one was Dane Alderson. He's like the age of our children now. My daughter's older than Dane. And so when he joined the band, we gave him a group of songs to learn, but we didn't tell him what to play. We really want the input from every musician. We want each person to play what's comfortable for them. And of course, it's got to fit with the band, and there's a certain sound that's been established, but there's a lot of freedom within that. And we encourage a new member to bring themselves to the party, so to speak.
So it sounds like it's a combination of what I used earlier, indoctrination in a positive way, but also respect for the member.
Yeah, that's a better way of saying it. Yeah, we have mutual respect, and it's just understood that each guy is going to make the music his own. And if you respect the music, that tells you what to play. And the musicians you're playing with, that's going to really be your kind of guide for mm-hmm. what to do. So if you find the right guys, it's really a joy. And so Bob has been with the band since 1990, so that's verging on 34 years. Will began playing drums with us in 86, and then he took a 10-year hiatus and returned in 2010. So he's been playing the music for a long time. I've been in the band since it started, and I just mentioned Dane, 9 years. So there's a lot of longevity, represented in the current lineup.
When you look at the people that come to your performances, do you find that, and I've asked this question of others who have had a long career in music and usually with the same band, do you find that your audience brings, for example, their sons and daughters or their grandsons and daughters to see you so they get an introduction to what you do?
Yes, we've seen that a lot. After the shows, if we're selling CDs or meeting and greeting people, which we love to do, and which we will be doing at the Smith Center, we hear all kinds of stories. Yeah, and a lot of younger musicians and younger fans whose parents have turned them on to the band. That's really, it's very gratifying. A really funny thing that happens too, people will bring in some of the older LPs or CDs, and these photos were full head of hair. Earlier, I completely, is that you?
Well, what's great about that, though, if you think about it, again, going back to gratitude, is that you may have less hair, but your musicianship is still great. And you're, as you said earlier, you like to learn and you like to grow. So you're still developing. And so you have that great opportunity. A lot of people don't. Some people that work in jobs and they reach a certain point and they can't they can't continue for whatever reason. So you're in a whole different world.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the great joys of doing this. And also a great humbler, because the more you understand and strive to know, the more aware you are of how much you don't know. And so that's, but I guess you have to come to terms with that, you know, a certain level of acceptance, maybe not that you're giving in, that you'll never reach those heights, but that you have a realistic expectation for yourself. And, you know, not musicians are notoriously really self-critical and really hard on themselves. And I guess, you know, people in all different areas, but that's not as bothersome these days, you know, kind of, again, maybe with age or whatever, you
comes wisdom.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah.
Yeah. We mentioned that you're going to be at Myron's at the Smith Center Saturday, April 20th at 6 and 8:30. So there's two shows. And you mentioned earlier also that you change it up with the shows. You don't do the same, which is a great way to do it. It keeps you fresh.
Yes.
And in between, you're going to be meeting the audience members afterwards to say hello and sign CDs and sell CDs and et cetera. Do you find that there's a common question that comes up to the group from the audience after the show? Is there one or two things that you're surprised that the question comes up, but it does come up? And I don't know what that would be. That's why I'm asking you the question.
I would say the most common question, and it's a good one, and it's our most dreaded question. How did the band get its name?
And so that's better than where did the hair go?
Yeah, right. Yeah. So that's one. And another one from, we also do a lot of workshops and sort of educational things. And until about a year ago, three of us were teaching at University of Southern California. I retired last year, but Will Kennedy and Bob Mincer still teach there. So we work with a lot of young musicians. And one of the questions that comes from young players is they're curious about how we create the music, how we write the music and kind of organize it and work it up to record, you know, whether it's, you know, one guy kind of dictating things, or as I mentioned before, that's not really the case. It's a very collaborative mm-hmm. process. And also the question, where do your ideas come from? You know, like, where does a song come from? And so,
you know, what's intriguing about what you're talking about is, in our society, particularly our society, not other cultures, but in our society, people who are older don't necessarily get respect from those who are younger, because people who are younger seem to think they know it all. And in the world that you're describing at USC, in the world of music in general, the fact that younger musicians, students, and others can realize that there's so much that they can learn from someone who has that experience, and asking those questions, where does the song come from, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah. That's, I think, true most of the time. You do, I do, yeah. Sometimes you don't get through to all the young musicians.
Well, yes, right.
But yeah, in general, and when I was young, I mean, I was looking up to the people who were older than me and had recorded and toured and had experience doing what I wanted to do. So, I think it's natural and it's probably smart to really try to learn from those who have walked ahead of you. Mm-hmm. And that's how I learned. And I have just the utmost respect for, you know, the musicians that I learned from. I mean, it's really like a shared process or shared experience.
I think it's a shared universe in that world.
Yeah.
When you were growing up and you started to study and learn the piano, did you have any, and I'll combine it it's just a separate question, but I'm going to combine it. Did you have any mentors and or idols that you looked up to? You mentioned obviously looking at some of the people who had recorded and toured. Were there some specific people that really affected how you approached the world of jazz and the world of the piano?
Yeah, there were. The least known of those people would be a musician in San Jose who he passed maybe 2 or 3 years ago. His name was Clifford Coulter, and he was an incredible organist, pianist, singer, just an amazing musician. And he kind of just stayed in the Bay Area. I mean, a few people outside of the Bay Area knew about him, but he was an incredible inspiration, kind of legendary to all the South Bay musicians. So Clifford was the first guy who really inspired me. And then of the well-known jazz musicians, you know, the pianists like Herbie Hancock, McCoy Tyner, Keith Jarrett, Chick Corea, and horn players John Coltrane and Miles Davis and all the people that moved, you know, went through their bands. Wayne Shorter, great inspiration, incredible composer. And then I was also listening to other kinds of music, like I enjoy and I'm in awe of the great classical composers, you know, Mahler and Stravinsky, and, you know, the list goes on and on. And then, like, I love Brazilian music and Jobim, Antonio Carlos Jobim, the great Brazilian composer, those beautiful melodies and elegant harmonies. Those people I mentioned are particularly inspiring to me. Yeah.
When people listen to music, I'll just make it personal. When I listen to music, the right kind of music for me, it does transport me. It does take me to another place. And usually it's a happy place, unless I want to be depressed, which I don't want to be. But how does that work for you on stage when you're performing music with the group? Are you also transported to another place? Is it a different zone?
We really kind of enter into this kind of world where time stops. I mean, you're just in a kind of flow. And I mean, I wish we could get there every moment of every performance. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there are challenges, like maybe the piano that I'm playing on that particular night is not giving me back very much, you know, or maybe the sound is a little funny. But when all the elements are in place and you can hear clearly and it's a good sounding room, I mean, yeah, you really go to another place. And short of that, I mean, the goal is to always transcend whatever obstacles are in your way. So we try to let the music just carry us, you know, carry us away, and hoping that, and I think it's true, the audience senses that as well. They really can pick up when things are connected, and or there's a moment like a surprise or a spark that happens, you know, an unexpected moment. I hear the audience respond to that. It's really amazing. We're kind of all on the same wavelength.
Because so. You have to be in tune with the other three as well as the audience.
Yes. I mean, it starts with the music and the other musicians on stage, and then we try to make the band sound like one thing. You're not hearing separate, you know, I guess you could if you wanted, but the goal is to make it a cohesive whole that communicates a certain energy and intensity, beauty. Yeah. So that's always the goal.
Do you get the same feeling when you are recording as opposed to performing live, that you hit that zone and all four of you are in that moment and it becomes effortless? Or is recording more of a, not drudgery, because you want to get it as good as you can get it because it's going to be permanent?
Yes, it's a little different dynamic. the aspect of connecting with the other band members is still there. I mean, that's always the goal. And we can do that in a recording studio, but you're missing the input from an audience, the excitement that, you know, performing in front of people can provide. And then in the studio, because you, like you mentioned, it's not just going to be played and then gone into the ether. It's something that's going to be heard repeatedly. I think we're all a little more, critical of what we're doing, and we don't want mistakes, we don't want errors, and so maybe sometimes you're thinking too much. Sometimes that's the biggest obstacle in recording, is not just overthinking and letting the music flow and entering into the moment.
Mm-hmm.
That can be a little more challenging in a recording studio, which is more like a laboratory, you know.
Well, also too, you have to realize that your kids are going to hear it when you're long gone, and your grandkids and your great grandkids. So you want to have it as perfect as it can be.
Yeah. And it's a balance between, you know, really having everything, you know, so-called perfect, but then
right.
You want the soul and the humanity too. You don't want to squeeze that out of it for perfection.
Good point. Before I let you go, who's the most important person you met in your career so far? Could be in the world of jazz or in the general world of music, that had an influence on you, not necessarily when you were growing up personally, but professionally, and then you got to meet them.
Well, there's a couple people, a couple icons that I had an opportunity to work with, and they were both, I mean, I mentioned Wayne Shorter before. I had the opportunity to play in his band for a short time and to rehearse at his house, and he was one of my heroes, and my association with him only, you know, confirmed that. He was an incredible human being, really unique thinker. So he would be one. And then I had the opportunity to tour for 1 year with Joni Mitchell. And I have the utmost respect for her. She truly an artist, someone who you could tell she's always observing, she's always paying attention, you know, tuned into what's going on around her. And that was a great lesson, just to see how tuned in she was. So those two people. And then another person who the Yellow Jackets has gotten a chance to make music with and is an amazing guy is Bobby McFerrin. Are you familiar with him?
A little bit.
Yeah. Incredible singer and a creative force. So those three, I think, they're kind of on my Mount Rushmore.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Russell Ferrante of the Yellow Jackets, and they're going to be performing in Myron's at the Smith Center this Saturday, April 20th at 6 and 8:30. So there's two shows. For ticket information, go to thesmithcenter.com. For everything about the Yellow Jackets, go to yellowjackets.com. And Russell, thanks for being on the show.
It was a real pleasure, Ira. Thank you.
Thanks. See you next time.
You've been listening to Talk About Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. Yeah,